little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry, you make it double. Don't worry.
Oh my God, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a marathon session of Hey Kids Comics. I'm your host,
Andrew. We are not responsible for how punchy we may get.
No, not at all. And if you're listening to this, by the way, I'm Andrew Farmer, as always, with me, the Jedi Cole Houston. Before we get into this show, if you get a chance, and it should be released about the same time, we have done a great interview with a young comic historian by the name of Will Miller. You can find his work on America's Mythology if you go to Tumblr and search there. It's the only place it is right now. But it's a thesis for
and not only class. If you, but you should.
You should, because it's brilliant.
That was an awkward-ass sentence, but...
Not only if you, but you should. That should
all
set you up.
My high school English teachers are now groaning.
By the way, speaking of tongue twisting mental gymnastics to get to a place that makes sense, tonight we begin look at that. That was a professional segue. Tonight we are starting a story arc called Comic Book Capers, all about true life comic crime and courtroom dramas. And this one is entitled what, Cole?
This is I'll See You in Court.
I'm pointing my finger.
I'm actually pointing my finger as I said that.
Did you point it up? Did you like turn it? Did you corkscrew it a little bit?
I just kind of just like give that jabbing motion that one would give in a situation like that.
Yeah.
I was actually feeling that one.
I felt it through.
Really, I felt like somebody owed me something here.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of people that owe a lot of people things, and nobody knows who owes what.
I was going to take the court.
That's right. This is issue 177. So a little brief overview about what we're going to do here in the next five issues in this story arc is it is about true comics crime. We've got this issue. This is sort of your entree into this story arc, your origin story, if you will. We're going to talk about a lot of comic book crime, a lot of court cases, a lot of things that have come to the forefront through litigation. We're going to go on to talk about such things as actual comic book theft, like physical theft of comic books. We're going to talk about art theft, basically IP theft, intellectual property theft from artists. If you know anybody who is in the game, as it were,
yes,
you will know somebody who's had something stolen and then resold or claimed it was theirs in one way or another. And then we're going to talk about real comic book heroes, people like the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund and people who've really comic book creators, not comic book characters, but comic book creators and professionals that have gone out of their way to really be heroes in this industry, instead of talking about the villains that we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely.
The entire time. And we're going to round this out.
This isn't Wanted, after all.
That's right. We're going to round this out with just the best story. We're going to do a real short version of our own serial by NPR on this one story about that will encapsulate everything that we've talked about here today and more into one comic book caper that I just can't shake. I just can't get rid of. But you'll have to wait another four issues for that.
Yeah, it's going to be worth the wait because this is a unique. Andrew found this, brought it to my attention, and I could not imagine a more perfect bookend to this series because it was such a unique story and one of the most bizarre tales, and it fits nicely into all of this.
It's what gave me the idea for this whole story arc. Was this one story encapsulated so many things, and it got my mind rolling. And it also happens in, you know, my adopted and Cole's actual backyard.
Oh yes, that's so true.
Because any weird comic stuff has to happen in Texas. That's a rule.
And I feel that it's almost like, you know, some of the local news stations where you have to put a Texas spin on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you shut up. You don't have to put Texas spin on it because you're in Texas. But in this case, we are.
In this case, it does have a Texas spin, regardless of whether you want it to or not.
That's right.
But tonight, we talk about litigation in comics. And this has been a tradition, a long-standing tradition in this medium, in this industry. court cases. Just a ton, just a slew of court cases.
It got to be, especially, I remember in the 80s, because by then the comics themselves were coming of their own, and people were paying attention to what was going on in the comics industry. And, you know, it left people, you know, you were hearing more stories behind the scenes and stuff, which you, in the past, wouldn't necessarily, unless you were incredibly connected, you never would have heard half this stuff.
Right.
And so a lot of the litigation became more publicized, and I don't know if it was as a result of or just because they were dicks, but Marvel almost seemed to take great pride in announcing who they were suing next.
Oh yeah. And to sandbag this for the coming flood, we wanted to lead in with this. And I don't know. I had heard about this back in the day, about the same time that I had heard that I think it was an April Fool's joke that DC was going to conventions and just fining people on the spot for having tattoos. Do you remember that story? That
it was
not real. It was an April Fool's story, but it could have been. That's the scary thing, is that it could have been a real story that DC and Marvel were walking around conventions with like a fine pad, you know, just writing out like a police, you know, ticket pad.
Like they had some authority.
Right, just fining people
for
having a Superman shield or a Batman logo or, you know, on a tattoo.
You didn't pay us for that. So
right, you didn't pay us.
Not
but
really going to pay.
But during the 80s and on through, Marvel and DC literally have been suing people that use the term superhero, claiming it's theirs.
Yeah.
So throughout the comic industry and outside of the comic industry, if somebody tries to use the word superhero, you might get sued by Marvel and DC if you're popular.
Apparently, the term superhero was jointly claimed at some point in history by the two super comic publishers.
Conspiracy. That's what I'm saying. Same New World Order.
Well, you know, and the funny thing is that technically, though they did not coin the term or the word, the word zombie was copywritten by Marvel back in the 60s, I think it was.
It was when, when they had their...
They had their eye zombie or...
Because that's the thing, they will...
Living zombie or I'm a...
I'm a teenage zombie.
in a zombie kind of way or whatever the hell it was called. And they would eventually come to realize that litigating that was going to be patently impossible.
Right.
And so they've kind of let that lapse long ages.
Right. But now you know what's really interesting?
That's not the reason they don't call zombies zombies on Walking Dead. They don't call zombies zombies on Walking Dead because they're smart.
But, yeah, so there's been a long-standing tradition, a lot of famous court cases that play a big part in our comic fans' lives that they don't even know. I don't think that a lot of people don't even register that these court cases have actually had an effect. The first one that I came across that really struck me was the Fawcett Comics versus National Publications case.
That I think is one of the strongest examples of just blatant misuse,
right,
of litigation of the court system of jurisprudence.
Because what they did was. This was all about Captain Marvel, otherwise known as Shazam, part and parcel. So essentially, National Publications would become Detective Comics or DC Comics, and Fawcett Comics, who owned the rights to Captain Marvel as well as the entire Marvel family, and
including Hoppy the Marvel Bunny,
which. I believe DC owns the rights to Hoppy still. They didn't just throw him a bone with Hoppy. Which...
Yeah, you think they would have just like, okay, you can keep Uncle Marvel, but the rest, you know, the creepy old guy who would like say Shazam and then take his pants off.
But the shitty thing, and a lot of this just pisses a lot of this issue. This whole story arc is going to piss me off. Because I don't like bad people doing bad things. And I have a feeling that comic book Bernie Sanders will be making multiple appearances because it's infringing on the rights of the comic
book. He's going to show up for this one because there's a lot to talk about here.
It infringes on the rights of the comic book collector, and I'm going to keep comics at a dollar, and I'm going to... use that money to fund public education on comic books. I have a feeling that comic book Bernie, I don't do it as well as you do, but I have a feeling that comic book Bernie Sanders will be making appearances on this show and the rest in this story arc pretty regularly. But the shitty part about this is it was an infringement lawsuit because they said that it infringed on Superman. So National Comics said that Captain Marvel was too close to Superman. And you're going to see that a lot in this. It's too close. You bear a striking resemblance to our character, so we're going to sue you for it. So what happens is through this lawsuit, because you know Fawcett Comics wasn't a big comic company. They had Captain Marvel. They had some other IPs, but they weren't huge. They weren't National Comics.
The only thing I really remember Fawcett from, of course, this will be many years later, was them having the publishing in book form rights to Family Circus.
Oh, okay, okay.
So there was that one where Billy said Shazam, and Jeffy was incinerated in the lightning bolt. That was a little sad, and I thought that maybe DC was on the right track after all.
So they sue. So DC or National Comics at the time sues Fawcett Comics for the rights to this character, saying that you can't publish anymore. It's too close to ours. The 12-year legal battle. And you don't want to know how much a 12-year legal business-to-business legal battle costs. But
I think that may be why by the time I was a kid, they were remanded to just publishing the adventures of those sweet little kids in
the unfunniest comic ever.
That's right.
So they completely just destroy. They run aground Fawcett Comics. They basically just drain all the finances from them. And like you said, they can't publish their most popular comic books. So what happens? They go under. They stop publishing. They don't put out any of their superhero related publications. Any of the Captain Marvel stuff. So in the 70s, what does National Comics do? They rebranded DC Comics in the early 70s, late 60s, and they turn around and buy all of the IPs from Fawcett that they drove out of business.
Exactly. And the really frightening thing about this is, okay, the corollary, the analogous, it seems such a stretch to say that Captain Marvel, a.k.a. Shazam, is somehow infringing on Superman. Because apart from, the Big Red Cheese having superpowers.
Right.
There wasn't a lot you could hang that on. But, for one, that alone, the fact that somebody says, okay, they're ripping us off. We got to sue. And I was aware of that, and for years I imagined that it was sort of like, how dare you? The problem with this case, or the biggest problem with this case, is that Fawcett was publishing Captain Marvel books for 9 years.
Right.
Before DC stepped up and said, hey, this is a ripoff. Okay, that adds a new wrinkle. But you'd still be like, okay, well, maybe it took them a while to really, get serious about it, or, for whatever reason. So, maybe you're willing to be a little bit forgiving of this near decade gap between a long-running publication and the determination that, we're getting stiffed here.
Right.
But there's yet another wrinkle that's even more telling. This book, this character, had been published for 9 years. That wasn't the problem. The problem for DC, the real underlying core problem is, for 9 years, Fawcett Publications was publishing a comic book that outsold their flagship book?
Right.
DC Comics would be damned if that was gonna happen.
Yeah, this was straight corporate vindictive using the legal system to its most black hat versioning. It's gross. It's gross negligence that this happened.
Yeah. It is so painfully a misuse of the legal system. And the fact that, as a result, they were able to... I mean, I think DC just figured... It becomes like Judge Doom, I bought the red line to close it.
Right, right.
It was never about infringement. It was about getting rid of a
competitor.
Directly targeting and getting rid of a competitor.
It's gross.
And, you know, ultimately they get the very character they fought against. And oddly enough, it almost seems like DC might have learned a lesson from this. Or just got interested in doing something other than being in court all the time.
Well, it has to get expensive, right?
Yeah, I think somebody finally realized, you know, hooray, we won, but did we really win?
Exactly. And speaking of winning, but did we really win, let's move on to our next case, which is the case of...
Next on the docket.
Yeah, next on the... Nice. I feel like we should have, and I'm going to go, I'll cut it in, but I feel like we should have the Night Court theme song.
Ah, nice.
Jack Kirby versus Marvel. This was recent, by the way. This has been a very long running dispute where, this is going to be a theme that comes up again and again as well. Except, you know, corporate targeting to stop a book from being released is one thing. This is, you know, Jack Kirby worked for Marvel for, you know, 50 years. For most of his life, when he wasn't working, you know, on Fourth World or whatever, you know, he was working. You know, it's Kirby and Lee, man. You know, and from then on, yeah. He made no money working for Marvel. No money, sweatshop money working for Marvel. In 2009, his children. Served notice to Walt Disney, 20th Century, like everybody who's involved with Marvel, and this is mostly because the movies were coming out and people were making money on them, they sued Marvel to terminate copyright and gain profits from Kirby's comic creations. This lawsuit went on for 4 or 5 years, and finally ended with, they sided with Marvel at first. And you were talking the district courts, the Court of Appeals, and they sided with Marvel, and they finally reached a settlement in 2014, but they didn't win the case. They settled for it, and it's another issue of corporate greed gone awry, because this guy worked for Marvel forever. He is a comic book hero.
Absolutely. Well, then there was also for the longest a fight over the ownership of the original art.
Yes, absolutely.
That led to tremendous public outcry as well as professional outcry. I think it was ultimately, professionally, Marvel was shamed into returning Jack Kirby's art to his heirs. And I think that the argument, though I did not follow it as closely as I might have liked at the time, went something along the lines of the idea of the ownership of art, you know, the original art ownership was sort of brought together, you know, where there would come a time where the artist maintained the ownership of their original art.
Right.
Once the stuff was published, it was returned to the artist, and the artist generally had an opportunity to make some more money off the original art. Meanwhile, all this archival original art was just piled up from decades in the Marvel bullpen, and... You know, post the advent of this, I think they were sort of like, well, hey, you know, how about giving Jack his art back because you've been sitting on it all these years? And they're like, oh, no, that's different.
Right.
And that did lead to a lot of consternation and...
Well, it also sets a precedent. You know, when you're in an industry where you've got all these guys and their livelihood is churning out page after page of art. And you're turning it over to these guys, and then you've got the granddaddy, you know, the progenitor of an industry, essentially, as an artist, being, for lack of a better term, screwed over by the company that you're working for now, and saying, no, that's our, they're thinking, what about us? What about us and the hundreds others like us that are giving you art every week? You know, is that ours? Is that yours? How do we do this? What's in the contract? You know, and it became too sticky, I think, for them to continue to just play, you know, dumb or play plausible deniability with.
Exactly. And that, I think, also helped put forth the entire the Siegel and Schuster
Yes,
that,
which
that
yes,
was
absolutely.
A tremendous booster to their heirs, because you could no longer fall back on, well, that's just not the way it was back then.
Right, exactly. And the thing about the Siegel and Shuster thing, though, is that they fought their entire lives.
Yes.
For the ownership of the Superman IP. I mean, they literally, they had court battles from 47 up to 2016. That is a long time. Keep in mind, they died, you know, of course, separately, but they died in respectively in 92 and 96.
Well, a lot of people do mistake them for Ching and Ing.
That's true. they were fairly inseparable, but and it's the same story. You know, they sold the rights to Superman to National Comics back in 1938 for $130, and it, back when it was a comic strip. Once it started finding some success, they wanted to be back involved in it, so they sued for ownership. You know, back in 47, 48, and then the ball just kept rolling on and on and on, up to the point where even now, if you want to talk about a more recent kind of situation that mirrors what's going on, the situation with the new Batman Superman movie was the first movie, the first TV show, the first anything that had Bill Finger's name on it.
Yeah.
And Bill Finger created Batman. I know that that's hard to believe, but this is the first move. I mean, and this stuff happens all the time. You know,
And the thing about it is you had things like, you know, when Tim Burton's Batman came out, the big deal was all about Bob Kane. Bob Kane himself, you know, had the good fortune to live to see this.
Right.
This big screen incarnation, which, you know, easily could not have could have just not happened in his lifetime, to see his character taken seriously. You know, the thing about it was you had this sort of acknowledgement, yet you didn't acknowledge everybody. It's sort of like, you know, you acknowledge one creator but not the other.
Right. And you know, the Superman case got, the Siegel-Shuster case got to the point where when Superman was getting ready to be released by Donner, they went and started and I'm always curious, and I should look into this, and I didn't for this one, and I feel bad, that's a piece of research I didn't do, but I want to look into what they did for this, because we don't live in the Facebook, you know, they didn't live in Facebook, Instagram, you know, 24-hour news cycle like the way we do now, so they created a campaign to draw attention to their mistreatment. And you had guys like Neil Adams and Jerry Robinson, and they jumped on board, and in order to stop the bad press that was coming, that's when they settled. So they didn't settle because they believed that it was right to give them, you know, their due for creating this monster, the most popular superhero ever to exist. Mm-hmm. They gave them the money to stop, to shut. It was literally hush money. They gave them, what did they give them? They gave them a $20,000 stipend per. I think it was. I think it was per year. But they said that they would have their credits in the name of all the Superman stories, but they would no longer contest ownership for Superman if they gave him the stipend. Literally hush money.
Oh, yes.
Literally hush money. And speaking of people that refuse to be hushed, one of my favorites, and I think Cole will be able to attest to this way more than anybody else because he was hip deep in this, is none other than a perennial show favorite and comic book warlock, Alan Moore.
Yes.
When Watchmen the movie
Alan
was coming
Moore, if he wasn't English, I'd vote for him.
Maybe he should run for Parliament.
If he was British and running for office, I would endorse him.
Do you endorse Alan Moore for are you going to bring him into your
Prime Minister so he and I can work together to make comics great again?
Are you going to bring him in to be your White House warlock, your White House witch? No, but so
that's a position for life. I can't replace that guy until he dies, and he's immortal.
So while
actually Washington's witch.
Case. Washington. Alan Moore, Washington's Witch. All right, now we're talking. Now we've got a comic book I want to read. Alan Moore. Somebody, please, for the love of God, especially if it's Alan Moore, write Alan Moore, Washington's Witch.
This immortal witch, and then, you know, when the time was right, he started writing comic book stories.
Just angry, just so bitter the entire time.
Why wouldn't you be angry after all that time?
That's true, but no, so when they were going to release the movie, the Watchmen movie, the ownership battle, and while it didn't necessarily go to court, the ownership battle caused Alan Moore to lose his mind. Just go crazy. Because, and we're going to talk about this later,
lose more of his mind.
Right. They did not want to, Moore and Gibbons did not want to work under a work-for-hire arrangement, which we're going to talk about a little later when we get into some of the movie stuff. But they did not want to work under a work-for-hire arrangement, so they basically said, you pay us X, and we're out. We're done. Like, you know. And then the way they explain it, and I think this is important because it's more, you know, he said that the way it works, if I understand it, is that DC owns it for the first time they're publishing it, and then it reverts to Dave and me, so we can all make money off of Slurpee cups, was his exact quote. Because Alan Moore had a certain disdain for all things physical.
I think the advent of the merchandising, he looked upon this as, you know, here's some good work, enjoy it, let it be what it is. We don't need to have, a Night Owl plushie or a Dr. Manhattan glow-in-the-dark blue dong at the, you know, at Victoria's Secret, or I guess that's a little bit beyond them, but, you know, at the Hustler store.
Does that exist?
I would like to see, you know, where it's that translucent with the glitter layer.
It's like, oh, God. Oh, God.
So it looks like it's just sort of manifesting itself.
Oh.
Manifesting
itself.
Oh,
my God. That's a mental image that I'm never going to be able to unpaint. I'm never going to be able to walk. No matter how many coats of kills I'm going to put on that wall.
Well, I'll just make it a little worse by, you know, you hear this sort of electric buzz behind you, and it's not a vibrator. It's Larry Flint wheeling up behind you saying, yeah, I highly recommend that
one. That one's the one I recommend.
That's a good one. It would be a good fit for you.
A good fit for you.
Yeah,
Damn it, Cole Houston. Damn it, Cole Houston. A good fit for you.
Because apparently they have two models. They have the comic and the movie style.
I like the one where you can buy in a crate, you know, so you can just strategically place them all around the room with the suction cups, you know, so you can recreate that scene in the movie where just everywhere you look, it's sparkly blue dongs.
It's like the green sheet. It's everywhere.
So he parted ways with DC over their contract for Watchmen and V for Vendetta, basically saying that they swindled him. You know, he knew what was in the contract, but still he didn't like it.
Well, you know, Alan Moore and hating things, hating what people do with his work is like a given. I think it's part of the contract. Is you're contractually obliged to put up with him hating you.
There is a clause. But I think the really interesting part of this is that after Alan Moore started to get lippy, DC canceled their Watchmen action figure line in 2000.
Well,
Do you remember that?
They canceled an entire, 20th anniversary celebration.
Right. It was 25th, and I think. Or no, 15th? Was it 15th or 20th?
It may have been 15th. It's either 15th or 20th anniversary. I guess it would have been about the 15th anniversary. And the worst part about that was everybody knew what was going on, yet DC had the audacity to pretend like, oh, it's just this little misunderstanding between friends.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't be a party without him.
And Alan Moore understands, you know, no one misunderstands better than Alan Moore.
Yeah, It was a misunderstanding of the understanding that there would be a misunderstanding.
And that certainly isn't the first or last movie issue, comic to movie related issue, because now we get into something that I don't think a lot of people are aware of, which is the work for hire agreement. And I think it's very important that we talk about it a little bit because it plays so heavily into what we've already talked about and certainly what's coming up.
Absolutely. And the thing about it is work for hire is one of those unique things. You'll sometimes see it mentioned. I remember Image, when they first launched, were made a big deal about how they've, changed the something like, changing the topography or the
the
nature of work for hire. And like, that's great if you know what work for hire means.
Right.
Because as a term, it doesn't make a damn bit of sense, just if you put those words together. Like, great, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
So essentially what work for hire means is that if a work is what's called made for hire, it's a work made for hire, right? So if you're a comic creator and you have a work and your in your contract is a work made for hire contract, the employer, so DC or Marvel, not the author, not the creator, is considered the legal author of the of whatever work you have.
It's a bit like, if you're the guy who does those really cool sculptures of the car and like, one quarter scale.
Yes.
For the design team, you don't get to then like take that home and give it to the kids or something. That's their clay and their sculpture and their work and everything that you did, all of the design team, that's nobody's stuff but the auto company.
Right. So, and one of the most blatant asshole moves, and this one pisses me off as much or more than any of the ones we've talked about, is back in 97 when the Blade movie was coming out, the Wesley Snipes Blade movie.
Oh, yes.
Marv Wolfman, who created Blade, didn't get any pay, any royalties for the movie coming out. So it was stated that the reason was, and this cracks me up, is that the character of Blade in the movie was sufficiently different than the character Blade in the comic book to not allow for copyright infringement. Therefore, Marv Wolfman was not going to get paid for the movie. So let me bring this back. The African American daywalking vampire hunter, half vampire hunter that Marv Wolfman created was okay, significantly different than the Wesley Snipes portrayed.
Nothing at all like
African American.
Completely different, Dave. Completely different.
African American, half vampire, daywalking vampire hunter in the movie.
I see no similarity.
Even though they were created under the same umbrella company, being Marvel Comics.
Yes, and they also have the same name.
The same exact name.
Same origin, same history, same MO.
The whole thing.
But none of that is arguably similar.
Right.
Much less identical. So Blade on screen and Blade in the comics, as created by Marv Wolfman, are as decidedly distant, logically speaking, as Captain Marvel / Shazam and Superman are the same.
Right, exactly.
So if you'll allow me, it's the same problem. It's like the Bizarro Universe Shazam story.
It's the Bizarro.
It's the exact same thing in reverse.
Yeah, like they're the exact same. No, they're different. Yeah. No, I'm looking at them. They're the, like, I don't know why somebody didn't walk into.
It's a sieve.
I didn't know why somebody didn't walk into court with a script and a comic book and just lay them in front. Exhibit A, Exhibit B. Take about 20 minutes, read them, and then tell me they're different.
Yeah.
Tell me how different they are. And in the same kind of idea, Gary Friedrich...
It's impossible to determine where one ends and the other begins. They are so inexorably linked.
Right.
That,
the reason that people went to see the Blade movie was not because Wesley Snipes... Well, partially because Wesley Snipes was in it, because it was based on a Marvel comic. The Marvel placard was up at the beginning. The story of Blade, the half-vampire vampire hunter, was the same as the one in the comic books that people had read throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So please, tell me how they're different. Not unsimilar, Gary Friedrich, which this one was... I remember this one, because this happened in 2007. Gary Friedrich created Ghost Rider for Marvel. Filed suit against Marvel, alleging that they infringed on his copyright to his character when they made the film. He said he won the rights back in the day. Marvel filed suit claiming that he did not own the rights and that he'd been illegally using the name and likeness for years to sell art and other merchandise at conventions. So Marvel pulling that card, which, you know, if you get too big for your britches, Marvel will pull you from a convention. And I've heard stories about that, and I hope that we get to talk about that later in the
I'm sure we'll definitely have that in our thoughts if we try to get that in there.
Right. And so Frederick paid Marvel $17,000. The guy who created Ghost Rider paid Marvel $17,000 for using Ghost Rider, the character that it created, to sell art at a convention while they were putting on a multi-million dollar movie of the character that he created.
Without any compensation at all.
Correct. Bullshit. That's what that is. That is just plain, utter, just wet trash, garbage smell litigation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is just like the fresh from the cat box.
And my favorite part of this is, oh, but don't worry, he's still allowed to sell his autograph on officially licensed Ghost Rider merchandise. So if it's officially licensed,
goodness.
Yeah. If it's officially licensed Ghost Rider merchandise, he's allowed to sell his autograph on it, which is just dumb. God, stupid.
And it's unfortunate because it comes down to that sort of privileged use of the law that I think there are those with enough money to throw around that they literally are, you know, they have a portion of their annual budget set aside for litigation. In the way that, you know, Sicilian merchants have a percentage of their money set aside to pay the mob.
Right, right.
And it's like right there on paper in their business plan. And I think that what you run into is situations like, what was the short-lived model-run restaurant? It was like a fashion cafe or something like that. It was like some restaurant that was like fashion themed that a bunch of Victoria's Secret models or some runway model types, like names that escape me right now, but like Billy Joel's ex-wife, that type of people. it was like fashion cafe, and they sued a pre-existing business that was like, you know, the cafe of fashion or something like that. And literally sued them out of at least their name, if not out of existence. It's like, okay, what happened to the part where they were there years before you showed up? You can't retroactively infringe on someone's copyright. Yet, who's got the big bag of money? Similar sort of thing. I remember reading about a pizza place called Buster Blocks. And when they came under the radar of Blockbuster Video, the then president of the now defunct company, I'll point out, saw to it that they were slapped with an injunction because he was afraid that people would get confused and buy pizza instead of renting videos.
So he sued them.
Chances are people are going to do both.
Right, right. You should have gone into business together.
I have met some stupid people in my day. But I can't imagine anyone being so ridiculously stupid that, like, hey, kids, let's go rent a video. Oh, wait a minute. This isn't Buster Blockbuster. This is Buster Blocks. Well, we'll just get a pizza instead.
Right.
That's the same thing.
We'll stare at this pizza for 2 hours. That'll be our enjoyment.
That's right.
It's wrong. And another one that
this
falls...
is every bit as good as Good Burger would have been.
Hey, that's not only a good joke because they're both food related.
Yeah.
Nobody gets to badmouth Good Burger on this show. but along the same lines, Steve Gerber sued Marvel's copyright claim to Howard the Duck, which was a work-for-hire agreement, stating that ancillary characters did not fall under the work-for-hire agreement, and he created Howard as an ancillary character. They settled out of court, but Marvel held on to Howard the Duck, so we would later have Howard the Duck in Guardians of the Galaxy. So that one worked out for everybody,
thank
I think.
Thank goodness they were able to maintain that. that, because that number one, we did get many years later. We got Howard the Duck appearing in Guardians of the Galaxy, and also we wound up getting to, I think Gerber had a hand in ruining the character for everybody in the later reincarnations.
I think so. Now we move on to one, that, and this will be the last one of these that we talk about, but it's the granddaddy of all of them, and that is Stan Lee Media, SLM.
Yes.
Oh my God, Stan Lee Media. The first thing they did was go bankrupt, the lawsuits began, in a way that could only be described as Vesuvian.
Well, you know, it's my father-in-law once said, you know, the railroads never made any money until they were bankrupt. And, you know, perhaps in receivership, they had plenty of money laying around to do what Marvel itself used to do best, and that's sue.
Right. Well, see, what happened was just a whole slew of weird and strange things happening. Lee parted ways. The Stan Lee Media became Stan Lee Media Inc., and then they sued Stan Lee, Marvel, and a whole bunch of other people. In 2007, Lee sued them back. Lee sued Stan Lee Media Inc. back, claiming it was committing trademark infringement. And then in 2007, Stan Lee Media Inc., not Stan Lee, but Stan Lee's old company, filed a lawsuit against Marvel for $5 billion, claiming that all of Stan Lee's assignments and all of his creative rights to Stan Lee Media made Stan Lee Media Inc. a co-owner. So the old company versus the new company. And then less than a month later, oh my God, it's
yeah, I'd forgotten what a twisted, it's like you thought Hydra was
right,
convoluted.
And then in 2008, the suit that was filed against Marvel was dismissed, so they would come back again and file another suit that was almost exactly the same in 2009. It's insane. So basically what happened was Stan Lee created Stan Lee Media, okay? Stan Lee Media went bankrupt and was bought by Stan Lee Media Inc. Stan Lee Media Inc. started using all of Stan Lee's stuff. Stan Lee then sued Stan Lee Media Inc., saying that it was trademark infringement what they were doing. Stan Lee Media Inc. then sued Marvel for $5 billion, saying that any of Stan Lee's stuff belonged to them. So they bypassed Stan Lee completely, went straight at Marvel. This is crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what their play was. Were they going to imagine that people would get enamored in the Stan Lee name and not realize he wasn't actually part of this?
Well, it just kept repeatedly getting thrown out of court, right? They in the end, where it all washed was in 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court. This went to the U.S. Supreme Court. What I just explained to you went to the Supreme Court. They were ordered to pay Disney, because during this period of time, keep in mind, Disney bought Marvel, and you don't screw.
Oh, yes.
You don't screw with the mouse. You might be able to get away with screwing with Marvel, but if you've learned anything from what we've talked about already, that's going to be a tough deal in and of itself. But when you combine them with the mouse, you don't screw with the mouse. So in the U.S. Supreme Court, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Stan Lee Media Inc. was ordered to pay Disney $82,000 just in legal fees because of all of
their
claims,
with the mouse.
And an additional $140,000 in respect to its claims regarding the American Music Theater, but because they sued them over the Star Wars musical, or not the Star Wars musical, the Spider-Man musical that came out. So then they ended up in February of 2016, they had to pay about $500,000 and went bankrupt. That is the most insane thing.
I think between their own legal fees and those of others in the cases they lost, they couldn't possibly have done anything but go bankrupt.
So I want to touch briefly, because we're going to talk about them later in this arc, I want to touch briefly on the comic book legal defense fund, because I know
before we get that, you were talking about not messing with the mouse.
Oh, yes, okay.
I think that's something that is an important case to cover here, is Disney strong-arming. We love to think of the, you know, happy Mickey Mouse.
Oh, no.
And with apologies to Rick, there's a dark side to Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't realize that one of the more, and I remember this because we were working at Diamond at the time this was going down. I remember there being a book that came in called The Uncensored Mouse, and it was shipped bagged with a jet black cover, and we're like, okay.
Yeah.
Kind of unusual. What is this all about? And come to find out that this book was saw all of 2 issues published, and then it just disappeared as quietly as it arrived on the scene. Well, The Uncensored Mouse was actually a publication of Eternity Comics in 1989, which gives me a time frame for when the hell I was at Diamond.
Sometimes your old man brain forgets when he's at Diamond.
That's right. I remember it well.
Pepperidge Farm remembers.
Chronology is not my strong suit. But basically, what had happened was, somehow, over at the House of Mouse, some 1930s Mickey Mouse comic strips, the unthinkable happened. Somebody fell asleep at the wheel. I don't know if it was like that Steamboat Willie kind of, you know, the big pirate ship wheel there, the whistle, and the, you know, next thing you know, hey, some 1930s comic strips lapsed into public domain.
Hoo-hoo!
Yeah, I'm going, well, who's whistling now?
Well, who's whistling now?
When things fall into public domain, like, say, the song What Shall We Do with a Drunken Sailor, it doesn't matter who wrote it.
Right.
Who produced it, drew it, farted it into existence. Once it's in public domain, it belongs to the ages. I don't care if it's Disney. And neither did Eternity Comics. They went out of their way to never promote this openly. I mean, it was titled The Uncensored Mouse. It had a black cover. It had no, it didn't even use any of the now no longer protected by copyright, may we mention that again, imagery that would appear within the book itself. I think the only indication was, I think the cover may have said something about, you know, 1930s classic Mickey Mouse strips within. Disney sued, claiming they never gave permission for Eternity Comics to publish their work.
Okay.
Well, their work, like the Star Spangled Banner, which no longer are,
like the Happy Birthday song, for God's sake.
Exactly. Ultimately, it took a lot longer to work that one out, but I'm starting to lapse into Civil War historian.
You are. You're slowly. Ken Burns' comic books is coming.
Harper's Weekly may have.
Oh my God.
The poem about the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored, but it now belongs to everyone. But, you know. That,
I'm horrified that somehow in the midst of all that, you kind of took an off-road into Dennis Hopper land. I don't know where that was, but.
There's nothing's better after studying old historical tomes than Pabst's Blue Ribbon.
God damn it.
They published this. They had 2 of 3 planned issues made it to press, but Disney strong-arming, you know, basically faced with that kind of Shazam.
Yeah. Mentality, yeah.
Political use of the, you know, misuse of the law. They thought, okay, we're a little indie publisher. They're Disney.
We will get crushed. We will get crushed.
You know, all they have to do is, you know, ramp up the admissions at Disney World, and that just pays for 10 weeks of litigation that amounts to nothing. They're just paying lawyers an exorbitant amount of hourly fees to sit around and twiddle their thumbs, because that's all it is, just a waiting game.
Right.
So they retracted their 3rd issue. But the thing is, legally, they were 100% in the right. And it should never have been an issue. It should never have been something that could be sued for.
Right.
But nobody, you know, there's no system of checks and balances. If you file a lawsuit, it goes forward.
Which is, which,
you have to be able to sustain yourself until it's over.
Right. It's just dumb.
And they didn't wait around to get reimbursed. And there wasn't, you know, Alan Dershowitz wasn't going to swoop in and do this pro bono and make Klaus von Bülow pay for it.
Jesus. But yeah, we're going to get into public domain a lot more. We're going to have a whole issue on it because you have a lot of characters that we see now. Dynamite has attached themselves to in a big way, these public domain comic book characters like the Flag and the Green Llama and... you know, these guys that you've seen out there, the death-defying devil. But if you look at these guys, you're going to see the original iterations of a lot of the comic book characters that we've come to know and love today being culled from these characters.
Yeah.
The Fighting Yank, you know, you've got guys like the Claw, you've got Cat, you've got Dynamic Man, a lot of the archetypes for what we know and love today, the Arrow of all things, come on, Amazing Man, which bears a striking resemblance to He-Man, Captain Battle and Captain Battle Jr. with their jetpacks looking oddly, looking strangely like certain DC characters. So you've got all of these guys out there, the Blue Beetle, you know, and I think that wasn't some of what Mystery Men was based on some open source characters.
Actually, Mystery Men, oddly enough, and I don't know honestly how it was credited on film. What's really unique, a lot of people don't realize, Mystery Men was derived from Flaming Carrot comics.
Yes, it was.
One
You're
of the
right.
most bizarre comic books ever, with a lot of changes, but I don't think Bob Burden really cared. He's sort of like in that regard, he's mild eccentric, in which as opposed to the fanatically eccentric Alan
right.
Moore.
Right.
And I think he's just happy to be there. So it probably didn't bother him that the shoveler just shovels very well and isn't the man that discovered the singing shovel of King Arthur.
Yeah, Avalon, whatever it was, right. Right.
Which is apparently a companion piece for entrenching to the singing sword.
But we will get further into public domain characters in their own right in an upcoming issue. But it's really interesting. If you go and you look and we'll get into this, at these characters, you can see every character that you've come to know and love today in a character that existed in the 40s or the 30s or the 50s. And it's very cool to look at and dissect those. But I'd like to end the show, if we could, on a high note. We're pressing for time, but there's one last thing that we want to talk about, and that is the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. The Comic Book Legal, it's so good. It's a non-for-profit organization. It was formed in 86 to protect the First Amendment rights of comic creators, publishers, and retailers. And that is the TLDR. That is the short of it. But what it really does is come to the aid of those that can't defend themselves against litigation, against court, and against defamation. So I know you have some stories on some of this. One of your favorite stories.
Yeah, this is one I cite quite often when bringing it up, because I am ashamed to say that I live in the state where this became an issue, where a comic shop owner was prosecuted by a local DA in some county in Texas based on an undercover sting in which the comic shop, which did not have adult-related, you know, they stocked adult-related comic books, but they maintained them behind the counter, out of sight. You pretty much had to know they were there to know they were there. And they sent an adult agent, you know, of legal age to buy this, to purchase adult comics, and then arrested the owner and prosecuted him.
Which is insane. That is a straight-up sting.
Yeah. It was basically, you know, someone somewhere is up in arms because they perhaps were in the shop when an adult bought an adult comic, and they panicked because we still, you know, to this day, there's still this perception that comics are for kids.
Right.
And therefore, every comic should be for kids. Even if no one else but an adult ever sees it, the fact that a comic book exists and it becomes this sort of subversion of law that allows these things to go forward. And more often than not, a comic shop owner's operating pretty well on the fringe. They're keeping their head above water. And the last thing they need to do is have their entire business shut down by some overzealous idiot who is brandishing the law, quite frankly, illegally. And the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund was created, sadly, to protect against just that kind of persecution.
Right.
And this was a blatant case where there was zero legal precedent, zero legal anything, but it basically would put this guy out of business, and it helps to provide legal counsel, to provide the funding for the much-needed legal counsel. And what was ironic about this is at the same time this legal battle was raging, I walked into a Borders or a Barnes & Noble, and they're sitting on easy access, low table, in those tables where they just stack a bunch of crap up, was the complete R. Crumb.
Jeez.
So I don't remember the titles in question, but none of them would have touched the, you know, the gross debasement of women that was illustrated in, like, R. Crumb comics, where, you know, you have these sort of headless female bodies that are just sex tools in an ongoing strip. And all of this stuff was right there with every single thing.
Right, right.
You know, it's not just Keep on Truckin' and Mr. Natural. There's some nasty-ass shit going on in Robert Crumb's stuff. And if you don't believe me, find the documentary Crumb, which, by the way, you should see anyway, because he's just
a
magnificent madman.
Yeah.
Freak, but it's bizarre and fun and engaging to watch. And a bit of a train wreck in its own right. But this was just one of many instances where this sort of thing was going on. And I know an unrelated kind of note of just, you know, brandishing the law like a weapon, there was a comic shop owner years ago who was reported to the IRS, which, you know, by their very nature, it's like any law enforcement agency. If somebody reports something, regardless how outrageous, they are obliged to investigate.
Right.
But apparently some overzealous IRS agent seized their inventory, froze their accounts, and effectively put this comic shop out of business. And frankly, the general consensus was, and I can't speak to this with any certainty, and no one can, but almost certainly it was a rival comic shop owner. And at the time, there was a comic shop around where I would not have put it past the owner.
Well, there's a war. I mean, that was the point at which the comic shop wars were happening.
Exactly. And people were doing anything to...
And it was really, you know, dead man walking, you know, 1940s mob-style Wild West, you know, right across the street from each other type. And it was a real thing that happened, you know?
Oh, yeah. We're constantly trying to find ways to, you know, in some cases, use legal means inappropriately.
Oh, sounds like a certain story we talked about at the top of the show
exactly.
With Captain Marvel and Superman.
Exactly. So you just sort of, you know, use the law to your advantage to get rid of your enemies. And, you know, a lot of the cases like selling adult material to an adult, which then would beg the question, where is the precedent? Why are we not busting down the doors of, at the time, every 7-Eleven that had Playboy or every
right.
newsstand? Or
why every are Maxim they, you know, magazine, every...
Yeah. In comic shop, they have a target on them. And it reminded me very much of, I had the good fortune, just a handful of years before she passed away, Kate Worley and Reed Waller were guests at one of the Dallas Fantasy Fairs.
Oh, okay.
And they were, Reed Waller had created Omaha the Cat Dancer, who we talked about on the Dirty Books years ago with Steve, amongst other things, as being what I consider the pinnacle of that genre. Created the character for Bizarre Sex comic book, an anthology, and then later through Steel Dragon, and then ultimately Kitchen Sink. Dennis Kitchen picked them up after Steel Dragon went under. Was publishing Omaha the Cat Dancer, and you can tell the second Kate Worley came on board, because she was a very strong writer, and it became less a, you know, a what some refer to as a stroke book.
Right.
It began to turn into a very engaging story that just happened to have funny animal sex in it. But one of the things that was wonderful that ties into this beautifully as a good bookend here, or as a good ending point at least, is when Omaha the Cat Dancer went to court in Australia.
Okay.
And because Australian law still, even more staunchly than American law, looked upon comics as for kids. And it was illegal to actually publish or import adult material in comic book form, which is ironic because they're the most laid-back damn country in...
Right.
It's my friend Stuart Ball said they're like the white Jamaicans. It's just, you know, they're laid-back and understanding people. For some reason, that little bit of puritanical law snuck into their jurisprudence, and Omaha the Cat Dancer was brought under fire for that. And what was amazing is a very brilliant judge presiding over this case declared that, if you're unfamiliar, Omaha the Cat Dancer, all the characters are, it's the, what was often referred to as the funny animal genre, which Mickey Mouse, for example, would be considered in comics funny animal. And it's basically anthropomorphic animals.
Right.
Over the years, the more technical and scientific sounding term of anthropomorphics was brought in to justify things like the comic book Albedo, or many other things like Bucky O'Hare and stuff like that, because it sounded better than funny animals.
Right.
So this judge looked over the material and decreed that the imagery portrayed animals engaged in animal acts and was therefore not pornography any more than imagery of mating livestock.
That's awesome.
And I thought, what a brilliant way to say this was a ridiculous suit. This was a ridiculous case that should never have crossed my bench. And I think Reed Waller equated this to say, what was wonderful about this is we went from pornography to animal husbandry.
That is fantastic. Oh, man. All right. Well, we've gone long. Let's wrap it up. I think we've done justice to the litigation. I hope nobody takes it upon themselves to sue us for copyright infringement or anything like that.
That's true.
But yeah, so next week we are Cole's aptly named. Cole named all these issues of this, and they're so good. We are talking about actual comic book theft, such as the Nick Cage, the famous Nick Cage, people stole his entire comic book collection.
Where's my comics?
Where's
dude?
My comics? There is no time.
There's no comics. There's They're no all comic. Gone.
That's not bad.
I have to go to Mount Rushmore to find them.
What?
Okay, if I don't find
them, I'm trapped in a painting.
This is a movie plot.
That's right. Called Exit Through the Comic Shop. So good. About actual comic theft.
Heist thefts, the disappearing, the inevitable stories of the big dollar comic that now you see it, now you don't, on the wall of your comic shop.
That's right. And so more stories of true crime next week. But Cole, why don't you plug us up? We'll get out of here. And again, if you haven't listened to it yet, listen to the interview we did with Will Miller. Great kid. You should check him out. He's got a ton of stuff. Very insightful.
Absolutely, and also very soon be having our another special edition is our Superman versus Batman Dawn of Justice.
Yes.
Which we'll try to do justice to that with myself and Andrew and Mrs. Jedi Cole joining the fun. Mrs. Jedi Cole being a huge proponent of this film. She absolutely loved it. As a comic book semi-outsider, definitely.
Really? Oh, I can't wait to talk about this.
Oh, yeah. She absolutely adored this movie, so that'll give a nice juxtaposition of thoughts. And of course, all of that and this is coming to you on the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us or sue us at... No, don't sue us.
But you can write to us.
Just do not send your legal briefs here, but...
But just your briefs. Just your briefs.
You can adjust. You can adjust. Damn it. You can write to us at JCUmail.com. You can look for our Twitter feed occasionally on the at the Jedi Cole U. And we also have a Jedi Cole Universe YouTube page. And I will actually be at in May at Texas Comic Fest hosting a production of Do You Like the Star Wars Game Show. And I'll have a table out there promoting the JCU, the Texas Convention Warriors Project Texas at cap-tx.info. And also be already the earliest, the first street team appearance of the All-Con street team, and selling some really cool stuff to help pay for all this.
There you go. So, yes, all that being said, join us next week for more True Comic Capers. This has been another issue of Hey Kids Comics. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody. See you in a week.
Good night, everybody. I'm going to sue y'all. I'm going to sue every one of you.
I'll see you in court.
I will see you in court.
I'll see you, and I will see you, and I'll see you, and I'll raise you.
Wow. I'll see you, and I'll raise you in court. That's something you can't handle.
Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, don't worry, don't do it. Be happy. Put a smile on your face. Don't bring everybody down like this. Don't worry. It will soon pass, whatever it is. Don't worry, be happy. I'm not worried. I'm happy.